On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Shih, Mr. Curtis Franklin on the show today, the happy travelers. Now, we've been talking about how the FCC speed standards are just too darn slow. We're going to get into depth of why they need to be changed and just how that might just happen. Plus, VDI has been one of those technologies that has always been the backseat of some organizations. Well, there's some latest announcements coming out about VDI, and it just might be your next environment. You shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 452, recorded July 16th, 2021. Humble Pie. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by PlexTrack, the powerful yet simple security management platform that helps you to get the real cybersecurity work done. With PlexTrack, you'll streamline your assessments, analytics, and reporting. Visit PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. And by Endava. Subscribe and listen to Tech Reimagined, the podcast from Endava, from wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Shih. He's a network and security expert, and he's an overall great, great guy. Shihbert, how's the happy traveling treating you?
Well, this is my first nice long East Coast road trip. We actually got all the way up into the Rhode Island area and visited all kinds of friends. And we are now outside our nation's capital in McLean, Virginia, site of GSA's big giant office building. That's the federal agency that I used to work for. So ought to be interesting. Maybe tomorrow we'll kind of sneak through the monuments area and play a little bit of tourist as we go through our nation's capital.
Well, I want to thank you publicly just to say, Shihbert, you I'm at gig speech all because of you, man. So thank you so much for all your help here. It's
very welcome.
So thanks, Shihbert. Well, we also have to thank our other enterprise and security expert. He's an all around amazing guy, and he's also a happy traveler, Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst, and I'm Dia. Curtis, how's the traveling going?
Lou, the traveling is going well. We are with Shihbert and family, and so I'm also sitting in Tyson's Corner, Virginia right now. I'm a little bit more obviously in a hotel room than Brian is, but we made it up to Boston to see some friends, including some faithful Twit viewers and our son. So it's been a good trip. Looking forward to the entertainment on the trip south, and then finally making it back to the Swamp Studio. So it's going well. It's nice to get away for just a little while.
It is. Well, safe travels to everybody. But you know what? We have a lot to talk about today. So let's go ahead and jump right into that. Because you know what? The fact that the FCC standards for speeds have just been too slow for too long. We've talked about it quite a bit before. We're going to go in depth why they need to be changed and how that just might actually happen for once. Plus, VDI has been one of those technologies that really sometimes has had a backseat in organizations. Well, we have some latest announcements around VDI and just how that might just be your next environment. We'll get into that. But before we do all that goodness, we have to go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, bug bounties are now a way for organizations to incentivize people to report issues and vulnerabilities. Well, it looks like the State Department is jumping right into that model as well. They will offer rewards up to $10 million for information leading to the identification of anyone engaged in foreign state-sanctioned malicious cyber activity, including ransomware attacks against critical U.S. infrastructure. A task force set up by the White House will coordinate efforts to stem this ransomware scourge. Now, the current administration is also out with a website, stopransomware.gov, that offers the public resources for countering the threat and building more resilience into the networks a senior administration official told reporters this week. Now, in another move, the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network will work with banks, technology companies, and others on better anti-money laundering efforts for cryptocurrency and more rapid tracing of ransomware proceeds, which are paid in virtual currency. Officials are hoping to seize more extortion payments and ransomware cases, as the FBI did in recouping most of the $4.5 million ransom paid by the Colonial Pipeline in May. The rewards come from the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. It will offer a tips reporting mechanism on the dark web to protect sources who might identify cyber attackers and or their locations, and also reward payments may include cryptocurrency, the agency said in the statement. Now, the new move by the government means that they're starting to fund the move against some of these large ransomware groups, including the infamous Revel group. Who knows? That could be the reason why that group mysteriously disappeared.
Well, we now know that attackers exploited 4 zero-day flaws in Chrome, Safari, and Internet Explorer. The latest evidence of a troubling increase in zero-day exploit activity this year is 3 attack campaigns targeting 4 separate, previously unknown browser vulnerabilities that Google recently discovered and reported to the respective browser vendors. 2 of the exploits targeted flaws in Chrome, 1 targeted a vulnerability in Internet Explorer, and the 4th affected Safari. All 4 of the issues have been patched. Now, according to Google, a vendor of commercial surveillance software appears to have developed 3 of the 4 exploits. At least 2 government-backed threat groups, one of them Russian, purchased those exploits and used them in attack campaigns before patches for the flaws became available. Google security researchers Maddie Stone and Clement Lassine wrote in a blog post this week, halfway into 2021, there have been 33 zero-day exploits used in attacks that have been publicly disclosed this year. That number is already 11 more than the total number of zero-day exploits for all of last year. It reflects both the increased attacker interest in finding and exploiting such vulnerabilities and the greater success researchers are having in detecting and disclosing those issues. Google researchers discovered 1 of the 2 Chrome zero-day flaws in February, the other in June. Exploits for both these remotely executable flaws in the Chrome renderer were delivered as one-time links via email to targeted individuals, all of whom were in Armenia. A Russian threat actor, believed to be the same one behind the SolarWinds campaign, was observed delivering an exploit for the WebKit vulnerability in a separate credential theft campaign targeting governments and non-governmental organizations in Western Europe. Meanwhile, the 4th zero-day vulnerability that Google discovered affected Internet Explorer. That campaign, too, targeted users in Armenia and involved an exploit that was likely developed by the same commercial vendor that developed exploits for the Chrome zero days. Yaniv Bardayan, CEO and co-founder at Vulcan Cyber, says zero-day attacks are increasing simply because they offer the path of least resistance for threat actors. He says, as IT security teams get better at protecting businesses from threat actors who exploit known vulnerabilities, these same actors are moving to sneak attack or engineered methods of hacking business. We are witnessing, he says, the economics of cybersecurity at play.
How much are you paying your ISP? The Consumer Reports wants to see your bill. Well, here's what they want to do. So, with broadband industry lobby groups implausibly claiming that internet providers have slashed their prices, Consumer Reports is on a mission to collect and analyze thousands of monthly internet bills from real customers. In an announcement this week, Consumer Reports said it launched the Broadband Together initiative with 40 other groups to analyze the cost, quality, and speeds that are being delivered to people and communities across the U.S. and to better understand the factors that affect price and why consumers pay different rates for the same service. At least one thing is certain before the analysis begins. The actual amount ISPs charge is a lot higher than their advertised prices because of various fees that get tacked on after customers select the plan. Quote, over 6,600 people have already participated. You too can join the project website, which says the process takes about 7 minutes. To participate, consumers will need an internet bill and an internet connection so Consumer Report researchers can test their speeds and answer a few questions about their broadband service. The group will analyze bills to compare companies' prices and services and figure out what consumers are actually paying for broadband. Now, I did talk about this article a little while back and how competition for an ISP has determined what you pay for internet services. Remember, I was talking about how someone one street away but does not have any competitors or no other options for internet service will pay significantly higher than streets that do have competitors. So, unless you object, please consider adding your 2 cents worth to the survey, and let's see if we can get ISPs to level the playing field. And oh yeah, I would also imagine this data could go a long way towards the efforts by the FCC and FTC to level the playing field.
Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's PlexTrack, the security management platform that brings you better reports, deeper assessments, and more insights. Now, do you spend hours and hours reporting security issues and feel like it's getting you nowhere? Well, maybe you're buried in data, but still can't get a full picture of your security posture to prioritize remediation efforts. We've got the solution for you. That's PlexTrack empowers continuous assessment, automated workflow, and effective collaboration between teams to help cybersecurity professionals do more in less time. Now, create assessment reports in half the time and centralize your remediation efforts across all scans, assessments, and audits through a powerful risk visualizations, scanner, and ticketing integrations, and enhanced analytics to effectively communicate risks in real time. Now, whether you're red or blue, there is a PlexTrack for every security professional to save time and get the right work done. Now, red teams can import findings from numerous vulnerability scanners. In fact, they can include screenshots and videos with auto formatting. Plus, they can create customized templates and export to Word with just one quick click. Now, streamline the report writing process to deliver better reports much, much faster. Now, blue teams can actually customize internal and external assessment questionnaires. Plus, they can synchronize findings with task management tools like Jira Cloud, and they can assign findings to team members and track status over time. And they can provide attestation of security posture with robust analytics. Want to learn more? Well, in-person events are back. That's right. And the PlexTrack team will be in Las Vegas for Hacker Summer Camp 2021. For those visiting Sin City for Black Hat and DEF CON, give a shout out to PlexTrack on social if they will see you there. Connect with PlexTrack at their hospitality suite and open house to see how PlexTrack fits your unique use case, or simply challenge your skills with their Purple Team CTF. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your month free. That's PlexTrack.com/TWIT. And we thank PlexTrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, the FCC's broadband standards have been, you know, kind of old, right? They were implemented under the chairman, Tom Wheeler, in 2015, and they were never updated under Ajit Pai. And you know what? They just seem too slow. That's right. The Wheeler-led FCC in January 2015 updated the agency's broadband standards from 4 megabit per second downstream and 1 megabit up to 25 megabits down and 3 megabits up. Not much difference there. Now, the increase was opposed by the broadband industry lobbyists and Republicans, including Ajit Pai, who was then a commissioner and later served as FCC chairman throughout the Trump administration. Now, Pai never updated those standards in his 4 years as chair. And in his last annual broadband deployment report issued in January 2021, Pai concluded that the fixed services with speeds of 25/3 megabit per second continue to meet the statutory definition of advanced telecommunication capability. Tell that to all the teleworkers out there. Now, consumer advocates have frequently called that Those standards were outdated, and the nonpartisan U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO, agreed in a report based on a review of research and interviews with many small businesses. Quote, much of the literature GAO reviewed suggests that the FCC's current broadband minimum benchmark speeds, 25 megabits per second for down and three up, are likely too slow to meet small business speeds needs. Okay, I want to bring everybody back in here because we've talked about this before. We know this is too slow. We know, like, for instance, Zoom's HD standards are even above that for meetings. So we know that these standards are too slow. The question is, what did Ajit Pai actually do? I want to throw this to Brian first. What did he actually do during his administration if he wasn't going to make big changes like this?
My personal opinion is Ajit Pai did absolutely freaking nothing other than mess up the industry, slow things down, and make America wholly unprepared for a pandemic. Mr. Pai, I'm sorry, but you are worthless and you do not deserve your retirement income. You didn't earn it. You didn't do anything. All you did was be a mouthpiece for large ISPs. Does this sound like I'm bitter? Well, yes, I am, because today I am actually on a cellular modem. I'm using a Cradlepoint just to give them a plug. And according to those old standards, I'm on broadband because I'm getting 40 down and 30 up. So according to that, I'm on broadband, but that's cellular. Oh, no, wait. Well, it needs to change. Students aren't able to do their work. Not only are the broadband speeds, the speeds themselves inadequate, the jitter, out of order packets, and latency of a lot of these ISPs is also inadequate. Because keep in mind, you know, even if you have a quote enough speed, if your internet connection has a lot of jitter, meaning the delay is variable all over the place, and the packets are arriving out of order, things like Zoom are going to be very, very unhappy. So off with my soapbox and say, hey, the new FCC chairperson, once they're finally ratified, we need to make some really big changes. And I got to admit, I've been hearing rumors that the FCC has told a few ISPs because they are so slow, they cannot claim to be broadband providers. Tiny, tiny baby step in the right direction. But I think we need to do a lot more.
I agree. I think I want to bring Kurt in because you know what? You know, a lot of remote workers out there still, kind of the new norm that's going to go around, you know, even though companies like Google and Facebook are, I'm sorry, like Google and Apple are kind of against it, we're still seeing a lot of organizations want to do remote work in the enterprise. Plus, it seems to me, Kurt, what do you think? It seems very anti-small business here. It seems like they don't want to, you know, make it easier for small business, especially in remote locations, to be able to have really great connections or even connections at all. What's going on here? Why are we not seeing changes here?
Well, I think that the reason we haven't seen changes, I'll put a slightly different spin on it than my buddy Brian did. Ajit Pai acted in complete accordance to his political philosophy, which was that it's not the government's job to tell companies what to do. It's the market's job. In other words, if enough consumers demand higher performance and express that need by going to competitors, then the companies will provide better service and better bandwidth as a response. That way, all of the customers win. The companies win by responding. The invisible hand of the market has done its job and life is good. Well, the problem is that for too many broadband customers, there aren't competitive offerings available. And you have either actual or de facto monopolies in place. One of the things that the pandemic has shown is that many of our systems have been incredibly fragile. Those are systems that range from the systems of providing entry-level workers for companies to supply chains, most visibly lately, of microprocessors for automobiles, all the way up to broadband. The U.S. Internet providers simply were not ready for everyone and every student working from home. Now, they would say, and you can barely argue with them, that they really couldn't be reasonably expected to be prepared for this kind of pandemic. But they could have had better bandwidth in place, and would have if standards had been continually evolved by the FCC. My personal take is that broadband connectivity is a matter of national importance and should be considered part of our critical infrastructure. That's just the way the global economy has evolved. And if we're going to remain competitive and safely participative in the global economy, we need to have the kind of bandwidth that is technologically possible, but comes at an economic cost to the providers. It's time for those providers to look at a few quarters of diminished return in exchange for better competitive advantages for the nation and longer term happiness from all their customers.
Great call out, Kirk. Great call out. Now, Cheaper, I want to throw this back to you because senators and a lot of the surrounding nonpartisan government agencies and other are asking for much higher standards here. 100 megabit per second symmetrical to be the new minimum. Is that enough?
Well, it's not bad. So I'm basically going to say, hey, Congress critters listen when you slam them over the head. Nowadays, it's email instead of telegrams, telephone calls, and so forth. You need to make your voice heard. So previously, I did a blip about Consumer Reports doing a survey. And that survey was you run it on your PC at your home and then answer a few questions. So if you do that from your home and then tell Consumer Reports how much you're paying, that kind of report is going to slam Congress over the head and say, hey, not only are there monopolies, but they are not even keeping their pricing consistent based upon the amount of competition. So that's the kind of tool that Congress will most likely listen to. And especially since things are changing. Now that we have a change in administration, there's a really good chance that by early 2022, there's going to be finally a Democratic majority at the FCC, and we will hopefully see a new FCC chair that's going to actually do something about this. Our internet standards in the United States of America are quite a bit lower than most of Europe, and I would really, really like to see that change. And, you know, not every, you know, I'm going to brag. Mr. Liu has almost symmetrical gig at his place. I'm only getting about 500 down and 120 to 150 up. Kurt has way less than that. And he's coming in over the, quote, new fancy dancy 5G services from T-Mobile. And I know for a fact he's not been real happy with it. Right, Kurt?
I think this is a case where one of the large cellular providers has rolled out internet service. And I think the kindest thing to say is that it's not fully baked. What we're getting is lots and lots of early stage pains, and I'm just not happy being an alpha tester for them. I might be willing to be a beta tester, but they're not to that stage yet. So I'm looking for alternatives, and I'm in one of those situations where I have practically none. I have effectively one cable provider. I have one DSL provider, and I have this one wireless provider, and none of them are making me happy. So I'm trying to find alternatives, and it is the proverbial needle in a haystack.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Well, guys, I think we have a pretty big topic to talk about after the bite. So I think we should definitely move on. But before we get to that great topic about VDI, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Endava. Now, season two of Endava's podcast, Tech Reimagined, is out right now. Tech Reimagined brings together leading tech personalities and industry experts such as Guy Kawasaki, Mary Williams, Alex Hunter, Brian McBride, Tom Gruber, Dave Coplin, Inma Martinez, and Viola Llewellyn, and many, many more. Now, the podcast discusses the big questions around technology and its industries. Guests and hosts will be talking about how these trends impact our everyday lives and how our relationships with technology is constantly reimagined. Now, check out the episodes Insurance Reimagines Parts 1 and 2, where guests Ann Norklin and Kevin Crawford discuss the role in IT and how it plays in the industry for insurance. Or the two episodes about the role of AI Reimagine, where Boris Segal and Radu Orgadon talk about the regulations and accountability and expectations that arise when using AI to solve complex problems. Now, they discuss what future holds for this technology and for the individuals who are using it on a daily basis. Interested in shopping? We'll catch parts one and two of our shopping experience Reimagine with guests Thomas Beechin and Jeremy Mays, where they dive into some of the most significant shifts they've seen in consumer behavior over the last 12 months, including increasing popularity of direct-to-consumer and buy online, pick up in store, and how the shift to digital is pushing people and companies to reimagine the way they shop. Endava has been reimagining the relationship between technology and people. Tech Reimagined explores this relationship on a deeper level with a look at the most recent experiences with technology and its experts. Learn more about how tech is becoming so much more in this world that's constantly growing and changing. It's a podcast you don't want to miss. Subscribe and listen to Tech Reimagined, the podcast from Endava, from wherever you get your podcasts. And we thank Endava for their support of This Week and Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now part of the show that I love. And you know what? Our guests today are all of us. We're going to bring in just the panel of Twiat hosts here. We're going to talk about a really great subject. There's some recent announcements around VDI and virtual desktop. But before we get to those announcements, I do want to go in a little bit into technology. Cheaper, I'm going to throw this to you first because you've been working with VDI for a long time. What is it and why should organizations take advantage of it?
Well, I think first off, we probably ought to go and make sure we all working off similar definitions. So let's start with virtual servers, then virtual desktops, and then virtual applications. Now, in reality, the difference between a virtual server and a virtual desktop isn't that much. You're basically taking a fully baked, operating system, whether it's Windows, whether it's Mac OS X, whether it's Linux, whether it's BSD, or what have you, any of the other operating systems. You create an image that is a fully functional PC. In some cases, you can actually take a physical PC, run a piece of software, which then will grab all the data from the hard drive, the operating system, drivers, the whole nine yards, suck it into a single virtual hard drive, and then bring that into some sort of infrastructure. Now, a server is going to be a server operating system. And that's what you start seeing from places like Rackspace or Amazon or Google. Well, to an extent, Google, or definitely Microsoft. It's a server class operating system operating in a virtualized machine. So this would be called a type 1 hypervisor. Okay, so let's define that. Type 1 means it's running directly on the metal of the computer. You know that old joke, they say a cloud is really just someone else's computer? Well, that is totally true. So virtual servers are running a type 1 hypervisor operating system like those from Microsoft or Amazon or VMware or Citrix. or actually Linux. In fact, Ant just brought up one. KVM is a Linux hypervisor that allows you to run host operating systems under the virtual operating system. So in the case of VMware, we run virtual hard drives. In the case of Hyper-V on Windows, we're running virtual hard drives. In fact, there are utilities that can translate the flavor from VMware over to the flavor for Microsoft or to the flavor that runs on Linux, which is KVM or what have you. Now, virtual desktop is defined differently in that it is still a virtual operating system running on typically a type 1 hypervisor of some sort. But in this case, it's a desktop operating system. So the difference between a desktop and a server typically are things like multimedia. Graphical user interfaces are different. You know, there's different utilities available to you. The other thing too is workstations also tend to have graphic processor capability so that you can play, you know, Grand Theft Auto, or you can play, you know, various other types of games. You need the graphic processor to render the 3D imagery. Now, a virtual application is a whole different thing. It is running on a virtual server or a virtual desktop, but in the case of what Microsoft has done and the case of what VMware has done is it allows you to run multiple instances of a application, say a spreadsheet like Excel or a payroll application. And it runs on one operating system and you slice it up just like you might have multiple apps running on your desktop now. But it only sends that data out to the users. So I could be running Mac OS X and I have a VMware cloud, say for instance, or a VMware server back at my office, and I have, say, a payroll application and I need to go and do payroll today. I then can log into the system, connect to an instance, just one instance of that virtual payroll program, and it shows up as a window on my Mac OS X machine. It might be a Windows app, but it's still running on my Macintosh. In fact, a really good application of this was when I was doing work with the University of Hawaii on building infrastructure management. We wanted to have laptops out in the field, or in this case, we were actually using iPads, and I was actually running 3D AutoCAD on that. And it allows you to basically run very, very sophisticated applications on something other than your native operating system. So I'm going to work with that for some definitions. And I think Kurt's got a little bit more to add to that.
Very true. Well, one of the things I just wanted to point out, there's been a conversation in a group of journalists that I belong to online where people have been talking about the new Microsoft announcements that we'll be talking about in great detail today. But there's a misunderstanding that I think is important to clear up. Many people believe that what we're talking about when you mention either working with a virtual operating system, a virtual desktop, or a virtual application, that what you're talking about is something that appears inside a browser window. Now, a browser window can be a way to access these virtual services. And certainly it's very common, especially when it comes to virtual desktops and virtual applications, to have them appear in a browser as they're using the browser as their presentation layer. But it's not required. In many cases, there can be small, dedicated applets on the client side that provide access to these virtual operating systems or virtual applications without ever going through all of the additional baggage of a browser. And so that's important. A lot of people will say, oh, you're just talking about a desktop or an application inside a browser. Can be that way, but that the two are not synonymous. So don't get hung up on the browser when you're thinking about virtual desktops and virtual applications.
Yeah, and I'd probably ought to say we did have two different companies on as guests on Twiit. One was Awingu out of Europe, and another one was Aircom out of Israel. Those are basically remote desktop apps that are running on a HTML5 browser. Definitions start to blur pretty quickly. So, hey, why don't we start talking about some of the infrastructure? So VDI, Virtual Desktop Infrastructure, was one of the things that I was involved with on a startup quite a while ago. And the cool thing is Microsoft, as of Server 2012 R2, I believe, made a really quiet announcement on this thing called Remote FX. It was one of the first times I had been able to have a virtual workstation running where I could share a graphics processor in the server and slice and dice so that I could have different resolutions, different number of monitor screens, and so forth, and be able to share workstation operating systems across the RDP client so that I could run things that were graphically intensive like AutoCAD. That was actually a huge, huge thing, and it was such a quiet announcement. But there's some really cool things that are happening, and I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop to the point where Kurt and I were actually talking about, well, maybe we should write a third book in our cloud computing series, this time on virtual desktop infrastructure. But why don't we do this? Instead of going into all the plumbing, let's start talking about that Microsoft announcement. And I'm going to preface this by saying that about 4, maybe 5 years ago, I was in direct conversations with a very large internet service provider on providing a concept called managed desktops. We were basically going to create a private cloud running desktop operating systems and using a cable modem, in this case a DOCSIS version 4 cable modem, that we had managed to obtain a RDP remote desktop client so that you could have a cable TV set-top box that you could have a infrared or an Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and suddenly from your TV, you could be running AutoCAD or you could be running Office or what have you. Didn't quite happen. But what did happen this last Wednesday was an announcement from Microsoft. So why don't we go to that? And Lou, can you provide a little bit of commentary there?
Absolutely. Yeah, so before we get to the announcement, I do want to preface this with the fact that a lot of organizations have implemented VDI in the past. In fact, I find now working with the Access team, the Access engineering team at Microsoft, a lot of people scale out their Access applications using VDI, allows them to share that Access database on the network, and then also allow them to have their Access application running in the runtime, very thin client-like, using a VDI session, and it allows them to scale that out. In fact, I use a VDI jump box to access a lot of my resources on different organizations. And it's very, very easy to scale those out, and it now can be done in the cloud. That's right, with the new announcement coming from Microsoft, they call it Windows 365. Now, it's a cloud service that introduces a new way to experience Windows 10, Windows 11 for workers, for interns, for contracts, for software developers. Now, Windows 365 takes the operating system to Microsoft's cloud and securely allows you to stream full Windows experiences, including all your apps, data, settings, to personal or corporate devices. Now, this approach creates a fully new personal computing category specifically for that hybrid world and the cloud PC. Now, Windows 365 provides that instant on boot feeling that enables users to stream their personalized applications, tools, data, and settings to the cloud across any devices, including Mac, iPad, Linux device, and even Android. Now, the proposed assumed cost of this, we're not real sure yet, is $31 a month, and that was reported by ZDNet. You could buy a whole lot of months for that cost, and even an inexpensive desktop machine. Now, I want to throw this back to you guys here, Curtis. What does this mean for the enterprise now that they've brought this front and center and made it really easy for you to set this up for your organization? And it integrates with Microsoft Cloud. It now has all of the advantages of Microsoft 365, all of the security, all of the approaches that Microsoft has done. And it's kind of that instant on feeling. What does this mean, do you think, for the enterprise?
Well, I think that it has several places where it can be applied and could be a real advantage. One is as an alternative to some of the places we're already seeing virtual desktops. There are certain application categories where not having an always present desktop is a good thing. I'm thinking of markets like medical fields. If you go into an emergency room or a hospital room, there will be a screen, a desktop, and all that. But that is accessing a virtual desktop in many, many cases. Why? Because when the healthcare professional comes in, logs in, they get their desktop, and when they leave and log out, it tears down everything. There is nothing there for a patient, a hacker, anybody who's just curious to get into so that they could threaten the privacy of healthcare records. So that's one thing. The place where I think this is going to be much more interesting to the enterprise, frankly, comes in support costs. Because using this, you get rid of having to support separate instances of Windows software on 5,000 separate pieces of hardware, or 10,000 or 17,000 or whatever the number is. All of a sudden, you're supporting that operating system on effectively one piece of hardware. And that means that you can make sure that every employee is on the latest, most thoroughly patched, most thoroughly up-to-date piece of software for the operating system. Has a big, huge impact on zero days. Has a big, huge impact on the cost of updating all of those pieces of hardware that employees are using. And this is especially important in the world of hybrid work, when instead of looking at replacing the operating system on 5,000 pieces of hardware that might be sitting on campus desktops connected to the campus network, suddenly you're dealing with 2,000 pieces of hardware connected to the campus network and 3,000 pieces that are out in employees' homes somewhere at the end of, well, the kind of non-broadband we were talking about earlier. So I think that it becomes a really valuable contender from the total cost of ownership perspective. I think there are a lot of things to be worked out, but this is, I believe, something that a lot of enterprises are going to be interested in, especially if they can get a good look at the licensing terms and find things that they like compared to their current volume licensing.
Good point, Kurt. So, Brian, I want to throw this back to you because I know that in the past, VDI and even remote desktop or RDP gateways were really challenging to set up. You set some up yourself. You know, what does this mean now with the service? Does it mean that goes away?
Well, it doesn't. I'm being nebulous only because what it's doing is it's combining a lot of things. So let's use Citrix and let's use the Microsoft RDP Gateway as an example. Both of those products actually melded together the effectively a virtual private network and a virtual desktop interface into the same thing, so that you had a relatively secure or very secure connection to a broker of some sort. In this case, we call them a gateway. Once you authenticate to that gateway, you're provided single sign-on credentials so that you can, from that single sign-on gateway, provide access to lots of different things. Now, single sign-on gate in general is a double-edged sword, but the whole concept of being able to layer your encryption as you access all this is really cool. Now, there's one thing a lot of people don't realize when you start talking about virtual desktop infrastructure. It reduces your bandwidth needs because you're not sending applications over the network. You're not sending large chunks of data. You're only sending keyboard, mouse, and video. Now, I will admit some of the video can be pretty staggering, especially when you start rendering the amount of video for something like Grand Theft Auto. However, you're still not sending, say, a copy of Excel. You're sending something smaller. So, thusly, when I was doing the 3D AutoCAD project at the University of Hawaii, we were only sending keyboard, mouse, and video from iPads to a machine in the data center that was running multiple virtual desktops and 3D AutoCAD, aka Revit, so that on iPads running over Wi-Fi or sometimes LTE modems, the students could actually go and make modifications to those drawings almost as fast as they're running AutoCAD or Revit on a dedicated PC. So now all of a sudden, if we have a virtual desktop infrastructure going, in this case, Windows 365. Now we students, maybe in farmhouses or in smaller towns, don't need quite as much bandwidth. So that's going to help, especially considering how much the FCC has been dragging their feet on upgrading that types of things. So you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting virtual desktop infrastructure so that you're not having to do huge amounts of support, say in a farmhouse in the outcountry United States, which might have a student, maybe a ninth grader, working on some physics problems. Well, if that physics program happens to be, say, a DVD install or a large USB install, and say it's, let's call it 50 gig of application. Now, instead of having to move 50 gig of application over that Wi-Fi, now it's staying secure in a data center, say at the Department of Education data center. You're using it. Now I can share it more efficiently. I'm still keeping within my licensing agreement because we're doing it by maximum number of simultaneous users. And trust me, this VDI world has changed enough with the licensing so that even something as expensive as 3D AutoCAD Revit, we buy lab licenses. So, for instance, for the building infrastructure management project, we had 10 simultaneous Revit licenses, but it was shared amongst 50 students, but we didn't need to use more than 10 at the same time. So now we could do a lot of different things on smaller PCs. I can make my machines last longer because I don't have to upgrade them so often. And oh, by the way, people like Weiss and HP make some really, really cool teeny tiny little boxes, maybe about the size of, say, a good size kitchen match box, kitchen matches box. And it's running a full PC, but it gets everything from the virtual desktop infrastructure. They make things called thin clients. You might be running, say, Android, or you might be running Linux, and it has a few things. So you can actually connect simultaneously to Citrix, to RemoteFX, to Linux. They also make things called zero clients, where they are dedicated to a single environment. And those are really, really, really popular with the healthcare industry because no PII, no healthcare information is stored on that machine. It can be thrown away and we don't care. In fact, a lot of hospitals, if something breaks in a doctor's office, they stick a new zero client in a padded envelope and send it through interoffice mail instead of having to roll a tech support person, which costs upwards of $65 an hour when you start talking about all their benefits. So it has huge, huge financial ramifications. It has huge bandwidth ramifications, and it has the ability to be replaced very quickly and very easily with little or no effort. I think there's a lot of wins. I've always loved VDI. I've wanted VDI to succeed, but it stagnated, which is one of the reasons why when Kurt and I were talking to our publisher, why I hedged my bets. I wasn't quite sure I wanted to spend the amount of effort to write a third book this time on virtual desktops. But, you know, we'll see. Hey, I see some notes in the back channel that Lou has some more interesting things to talk about. Let's roll to that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, the fact that there's still a lot of remote workers out there. And there's a lot of ways organizations can implement and secure, you know, allowing remote workers accessing from their home machines or even from their home networks, and to secure access to their resources. So I want to throw this to Kurt because I know he talks a lot about zero trust, and the fact that you get a remote worker, they're accessing from their home machine. Does VDI help with, getting closer to the zero trust model?
You know, it does. That's one of the things that has been talked about for a long time, back from when we were calling these thin clients, because all of a sudden there's much less going on at the edge. There's much less happening out on the consumer or employee desktop. Basically, all they're doing is signing in to a presentation layer on at their location, and then all of the subsequent processing, all of the data, everything else is held at a central location where it is much more easily secured. And one of the very nice things is that using the technology, there's much less that goes back and forth between the two ends. You know, basically all you're exchanging after the login is presentation data. You know, so all that's coming back out are the instructions required to render the screen and the environment on the employee's device. All that goes from the employee to the actual processing are keystrokes and mouse clicks. So there's much less potential for something to take root on the employee device and then move laterally through the entire organization. That's got to be considered a very, very good thing from a security standpoint. The question that a lot of people have, and Lou, I think you're probably someone who's well positioned to answer this. We're used to having things like personal productivity and office productivity applications in the cloud. Office 365 is an example. Google apps are an example. So we're accustomed to that. But we can really use all of those things without having a Windows desktop rendered on our end devices. I mean, I can get to Office 365 from a Chrome laptop, for heaven's sake. So my dual questions are, what kinds of applications require a virtual desktop operating system rather than just the virtual applications? And then, are there limits to what can the kind of application that can be run on a virtual desktop? Are there things that are so resource intensive that they're still going to require that local processing to get satisfactory performance?
It's a good question. I think that a lot of in a lot of organizations, they want they tend to deploy large applications and have to deploy them with settings and policies, and they have to do that to all users' client machines. I give an example. You know, today people deploy Outlook, the mail client. It sounds simple, but sometimes they deploy Outlook with a lot of different add-ons that do antivirus scanning and spam scanning and all that stuff at the client layer, not even just at the server layer. And so I'm not saying that that's a good candidate for this, but that's an example of a client application that takes a lot of configuration. And when there's updates and when there's when there's policy changes, it requires that you need to scale out all of those things to all the remote machines, that like for all the laptops, all the salespeople, all of that. And it could be costly. I mean, and not only that, it takes a long time to propagate throughout all of the different clients that are out there. Now with VDI, a lot of that tends to go away because now you're updating a server session, this golden image, this golden session that when somebody connects to it, they have the latest and greatest. And that allows them to scale it out in a sense. So when it comes to specific applications, it can be really any application that has that really poor deployment and latency for deployment that causes an IT person to take a bunch of time to do. Now, I worked with organizations. I actually went on site to an organization in Chicago once, and we were working with one of their departments, big financial organization. And they were deploying changes to just their mail client, and they had separate like war rooms to do these things. Like they would talk about how they were going to test it in their UAT environment, and they make sure all the policy changes were correct, and see how it impacted users, and check their memory, and all that stuff. And it was very expensive. I mean, there's a lot of people that were part of all of these changes, and I think VDI can actually help with that. It helps scale a little bit more for your organizations. Now, applications that might not work for VDI, Brian brought up some that could work well. Like for instance, if you were trying to scale out graphical applications, like Photoshop, 3D CAD type things, but things that are really CPU intensive, that you might want really low latency to come from them, then sometimes having client based applications in a really big box sit under desk really be helpful for that. But in the same sense, with these new scaling out and virtualizing GPUs, you can even get that performance from that too as well. So there's not a lot of limitations when it comes to VDI. But I do want to throw this to G-Bert, because you have some.
I need
well.
To jump in.
Yep.
Yeah, actually, Skype is one of those applications that break under VDI because you have echo cancellation. And if the echo cancellation algorithms are running at a remote data center, now all of a sudden it's not measuring the latency correctly. Well, interestingly enough, the problem was actually solved by two different organizations almost at the same time. Citrix solved it by putting a tiny stub of a signal processor actually into the thin client that sits out at the remote end. Microsoft actually did the same thing with the remote FX client. I had a nice conversation with Francois Dorimoux, who owned the product line at the time, for their video conferencing. And let's just put it this way. Smart people worked on the problem and fixed it. So the amount of things that can or can't run in a virtual desktop environment is shrinking very rapidly. In fact, one of the things that I did bring with me from my old lab was an HP server. It's a DL380. In my case, I have a Gen 7. But it can have up to 6 graphical processor cards inside it, and grand total that has 120 cores to play with, and the physical limitation on that server is 5 terabytes of RAM. That makes one heck of a VDI machine, and because not everybody is using that much resources all at one time, I can divvy it up amongst my users and provide a lot of AutoCAD or a lot of paint programs or a lot of this or that, even though I'm actually providing, in many cases, more resources than I might be willing to pay for on a desktop. So the balance beam
tips back and forth. VDI has some really, really interesting capabilities, and maybe it's time I seriously get off my butt and write that VDI book.
Indeed, indeed. You're setting yourself up for some future accolades. That's great. Well, guys, you know, a great topic. Thank you so much. I think there was probably a lot more to talk about here from VDI perspective, but we'll have to wait for another show because unfortunately all good things come to an end. Folks, you've done it again. You sat through another Out of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. But I want to thank these guys here, these amazing guys. They are my co-hosts. They are my friends and they are amazing. So I got the very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chi, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you?
Big thanks to everybody that helps make this show possible. I'm going to have a quick tease. For those of you that have been with us since the very beginning, an old friend might be joining us very soon. We'll see. We're working on the paperwork and logistics, but we're going to be adding another co-host so that if Kurt or I want or Lou wants to take a vacation, we can. Anyway, we're going to have a lot of fun, a lot more topics. We're going to shuffle the program format around just a bit in the coming year as we get towards the end of the year. And I'm going to make an attempt. I'm trying to get more of the topics you folks have been asking and demanding and screaming for. And we're going to try and shoehorn them in faster and with a little bit less lead time so that you can see your requests show up on the show faster. But we've got lots of time. We want to get those ideas from you. On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or you're more than welcome to drop me a email. I am Chebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv, or better yet, drop a line to Twyatt at twit.tv, and that will hit all the hosts. Looking forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Chima. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis is a very busy guy. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you?
Well, after I get back from my week-long vacation ends today, I'm going to be getting ready for Black Hat and DEF CON. I'm actually going out there in person for the week, so that's going to be exciting. I've got the last of some recordings to do. Setting up lots of appointments. So if you are someone who's in the industry, some vendor who would like to talk to me, please drop me a line. You can do that, by the way, kurt.franklin@omdia.com. And if you're just a member of the Twyatt Riot, well, I shouldn't say just a member because you're special. You're the most valuable people out there. But if you're a member of the Twyatt Riot, hit me up on Twitter, KG4GWA, with a direct message. Would love to get together with you while I'm out there at either show. Should be really interesting to see how things go this year. And boy, howdy, I'm looking forward to being out and amongst all of you once again.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you guys for being here. Wouldn't be a great show without you. Well, just like Kurt said, you are great people. We also have to thank you because you are the person who drops it each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the information about the shows, stories, the guest information, URLs that we talk about. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen in on any one of your devices. Because you know what? We're on all those applications out there, those podcast applications. So check it out. Definitely all of them, including YouTube. So definitely subscribe. Plus, you may have heard Club Twit. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. Now, one of my favorite things about Club Twit is the exclusive members-only Discord channel. Some great discussion and characters out there. All the hosts are out there. Leo's out there. We have some great topics, and we talk about every show. We have channels for all the shows. It's a great place to be. So definitely check that out and be part of the conversation and the content out there. Join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/Twit. Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of TWI. Because you know what? We talk about a lot of fun tech topics on the show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live. That's right. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the behind the scenes. That's live.twit.tv. It's really fun to watch the show live. I definitely watch a lot of the shows live myself. Come see all the behind the scenes. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room as well. We have an IRC channel. It's been there for years, and we have a lot of great characters and a lot of great stuff out there. So definitely check it out, irc.twit.tv. Definitely be part of that discussion if you're going to be watching the show live as well. In fact, go ahead right now, hop over to Twitter right now and follow me at twitter.com/LouMM, because I also post a lot of latest and greatest tidbits for enterprise, plus some announcements a lot of the weeks. And of course, I also have some great conversations with people like you. So I want to continue to do that. So definitely subscribe and even send me a message, maybe some show ideas. So definitely do that. Now, if you want to know what I do at Microsoft, go check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There is all the latest and greatest ways you can customize your Office experience to be more productive for you and your organization. To definitely check out Office Scripts, because it is the latest and greatest way for you to customize your Office Online, your Excel Online experience, to capture those macros and record them and play them in a web experience. So definitely do that and check that out. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. And of course, thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. We couldn't do the show without them. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He gets all the show bookings and the plannings for the show, and we couldn't do this show without him. So if you want to see a show out there, a specific topic, definitely reach out to him. Or again, reach out to that TWI at twit.tv alias, because we want to hear from you. Now, before I sign out, I also want to thank our editor for today, Mr. Victor. He's back, and he's making us look good behind the scenes. So thank you, Victor, for all your support. Of course, our TD for today, the famous and the infamous, talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, what's going on for you at Twit this week?
Well, it's been a little busy for us. I even had the opportunity to do Tech News Weekly with Mr. Micah Sargent. Ooh. And yes, I actually put a tie on because, you know, I wanted to show some love for Mr. Sargent and his swag and how he rolls, even though nobody knew I had on sweatpants underneath all that. So check that out.
Good.
twit.tv/TNW.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ant. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWI.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you are interested in checking out all things smart home and Internet of Things, then you should check out Smart Tech Today, the podcast I, Micah Sargent, do with my co-host Matthew Casanelli. It's all about the smart home and improving your automations.